Welcome everyone to today's Programming Languages. Today we're gonna have a look at one step in the direction of metaprogramming, and the approach that I'm gonna show you today is aspect-oriented programming. So what this is once again a spotlight on a way of organizing and modularizing the software that you write. And what we're going to see in that in this unit here is the motivation and the basics of aspect-oriented programming, the particular way of how to bundle aspects and perform the actual mix into the regular control flow of your software packet. Going to talk about special terms in aspect-oriented programming like join points, point cuts, and advice. We're going to have a look at the particular point cut designators you can compose in order to create more complex matching points, and then have a look at the implementation of advices and point cuts in the end. So, let's have a look at what actually led to aspect-oriented programming. So what you have seen so far is a idea of structuring your code such that the structures are directly reflected in the code blocks that are in the end executed on the machine. If you have a look at larger systems where a lot of different a lot of different aspects are of interest for the actual users and the programmers of the system, you might realize that if you look into how to integrate these aspects into your existing software, you will in some cases realize that you would have to touch a lot of different places and smear the functionality of that just realizes that particular aspect throughout the whole code. That is the so-called tangling of aspects. And what you really would like to do is to really focus on just these plain aspects and kind of keep all the functionality that is related to that particular aspect in one place and not distributed over your complete class hierarchy. And this leads to the idea of aspect-oriented programming. So what we do in aspect-oriented programming is you express a system's aspects of concerns for that actually are concerning several modules, and in that sense so-called cross-cutting the modules that you have, and you concentrate them in your so-called aspects, and then have a software component called the Weaver automatically combine the aspects that you have defined in one place into the different locations of the program that are related to these aspects. So in terms of graphical representation, what you have in a common system is this way of functionally decomposing in your design and then having the compiler compose a program out of that, but still the units that the compiler produces are somewhat one-to-one related to the original design objects, and that is what you see here with the colors. In the aspect-oriented decomposition and composition through the Weaver, you get to concentrate your code within aspects, which are then woven together in this aspect weaving phase, such that you actually mix code from different modules into your final product. And that's what you see with these different colors in each of these strings here. So there's aspects from several modules coming together to form your actual program. This all sounds nice and promising, but well, does it hold up to what it promises? So there's, first of all, the question, is there actual need for something like this? And example concerns may be, for example, things like, well, for example, error logging. Error logging is, if you do that with your common tools, you will usually spread out a lot of console printouts throughout your complete program, and you have a hard time in collecting them and removing them if you then in the end try to push your program to production state. And yeah, still you have to touch a lot of different places in your code while it's still one common aspect, the aspect of actually communicating with the logging services or directly the console, depending on whatever kind of technology you're using there. There's other typical concerns, for example, security. Think of things like SQL injection. You would like to, in general, at all places where you at some point interact with your SQL database, you would like to make sure that there's no escaping occurring in the actual SQL statements. And you could either kind of distribute this kind of code throughout your complete database connecting application, or you might want to keep that in one particular aspect and focus on the actual algorithms in your main program. Other things might encompass things like error handling or validation of input fields, or even things like profiling. So all of these somewhat touch the whole code base, although they are all just one particular concern and could be combined into one aspect that the program has. So there's definitely potential for grouping similar things together, and that is what, for example, the approach in Aspect J does. So that is the example system that we're going to look at. I think, as far as I'm aware, the only other major language where aspect-oriented programming has some kind of clause in real code is C and C++. I think for other languages, I have not really seen any real approach. Does, by the way, anyone have, has anyone had already contact with aspect-oriented programming? There was a certain hype like 10 years ago, but I'm not so sure whether it got actually popular. Well, we'll see. So, what can you do with aspect-oriented programming? What you usually want to do is you want to you want to perform so-called cross-cutting. So, you want to intercept certain events during the program's run and have callbacks for these events where you can place your own code inside and then let the program continue with whatever it had to do until the next interesting event happens and you get control again. And you can do that in several ways, and one of the ways to do so is the so-called static cross-cutting. So what is that about? This is usually talking about adding functionality in terms of so-called external definitions to your program. What does that, for example, mean? Well, let's have a look at the example over here. This is the famous expression evaluation example that you're probably quite tired about by now if you've done the tutorials. But I, with such common examples, I usually don't need a lot of time introducing that. For our purposes here, we have an abstract base class expression and concrete classes, constants, and some representation called add, and they extend this expression thing, and then you can build up a tree of expressions that are either sums or constants, and this will make up a complete tree. Usually in practice you have a lot of more different kinds of expressions in there, up till the point where you reach a potential programming language with something like that. But anyhow, the way to perform external definitions in something like aspect J is to collect them in something that we call an aspect. In our case, it's the aspect of expression evaluation. And there you see definitions of methods with the targeted carrier of that functionality in its signature. So what this first line means is that you would like to add an abstract evaluation function to the expression class that is meant to return an integer, for example. And it's external, it's an external definition in the sense that it's defined outside of the actual class definition of expression. Then there's other other external definitions added for the concrete expression classes constant and add, and they carry concrete semantics in the sense that they return the actual value of a constant or return the computation that needs to be carried out for an addition. So that being added in an external fashion, you can evaluate the expressions now that beforehand were just like constant content in your memory. So yeah, you have bundled all the functionality for evaluation in one spot. Didn't have to rely on things like multiple dispatching or visitor structures. You could do that in one place without such a thing. And the whole thing works in the way that the system kind of rewrites the original program such that it adds the relevant parts to the class definitions that have not been there before, and this ends up in a similar way as you see on the right hand side. So the external definitions are in that sense inlined to the places where they would have to reside in their counterparts. So this eval, this abstract eval goes here, constant evaluation goes here, and the adds evaluation goes here. So this is kind of the process of weaving the aspect's functionality into the original program. So what you see here is kind of code rewriting going on, and that's why this is already one step in the direction of metaprogramming. You have a program that defines how another program is modified. You are still in an environment where you have a kind of a two-layered system, where there is a targeted system with one language and a modification language that is a different one to the one before. So it's an inhomogeneous system in that sense, but still it can be considered as one approach to, or as a particular approach to metaprogramming. So anyway, still there's more to the whole system, particularly the dynamic cross-cutting, and that is where the actual interesting stuff happens, because all these external definition things, you can imagine that this is quite basic in that sense. So this, for this we need to clarify a few special terms that are used in the context of aspect-oriented programming, and that is, well, first of all, the so-called join points. And you might remember me talking before about these events that happen during program runtime. That is exactly what these join points are about. Join points are the set of events that can be tracked by such an aspect-oriented system. So you cannot really catch all the different events that happen throughout the execution of a program with the technology here, but there's a few points in program execution that are identifiable even after the source program has been compiled into bytecode, and can be if it's specified correctly, it can be localized in the actual program and in the actual bytecode, and at bytecode layer you can rewrite this part where this easily identifiable join point has been located, and the relevant code that has to be woven into can be placed in there around or before or after or whatever it makes sense. So what are these easily identifiable codes, points? These are these join points. There's a few of them that I have listed. I think I have omitted a few more exotic ones it's not so broadly interesting, but the most interesting ones might be the following. So there's the idea of the join point at a method or constructor call. This is the event where the actual method call statement is interpreted in the virtual machine. Then there's the method or constructor execution, which is when the individual method is actually executed. This sounds awfully similar to what I've said before, so is there a difference between those two? Or is it just the same? Yes? This is almost exactly what this is all about. So you must keep in mind that we have talked about things like method dispatching and things like a static call signature and an actual dispatching target. And if you just read a particular static call signature, it is by far not clear where that actually dispatches to. There could be several candidates depending on the actual runtime value of the underlying receiver, for example, and that can be drastically different than the static type of the receiver that is actually there. So when we talk about the method or constructor call and the method or constructor execution, the method constructor or constructor call is about the static type of the call expression. So this is an event that is triggered whenever in my bytecode execution I reach a call expression with a particular static method signature. That doesn't necessarily mean that exactly this signature will also be the signature of a method where it's dispatched to, but it is about matching a particular signature at the call site. Contrary to that is the idea of execution of a particular method, in the sense of executing a method of a particular signature. This is about, well, this is only triggered whenever the signature of the method that you parameterize this particular join point with is actually dispatched to. So it doesn't necessarily mean that the original call expression was of that signature, but whenever control actually dispatches to that particular method, then this event triggers. So this is the disambiguation between those two. And yeah, since in this explanation you have heard me talk a lot about bytecode level of interpretation of these things, you can already imagine that the implementation of the whole system is heavily reliant on reading bytecode, manipulating bytecode, and all that. And these are the only things that the things that can be found in bytecode are then the only criteria for an actual event to trigger or not to trigger, depending on what happens during runtime. Anyway, other interesting join points are, for example, situations where a particular attribute is read, in the sense that there's a field gotten from a particular object. So that is an event that might be of interest. Maybe also setting that field is of interest. Then what you can also isolate in bytecode is, for example, when the exception handler is executed. That is also a point where you can inject code. Class initialization might be of interest, or object initialization. So there's the constructor, but there's also implicitly initialized objects and even attributes, for example, where you have the initializer given in a class body, for example. This may this needs a particular code sequence to actually initialize this in reality, as well as there's the so-called static block that you can include in Java classes, where you can put initialization code that is relevant for static fields of that particular thing. So these are also both executions that are easily identified in bytecode and can be can serve as injection points for actual custom code. So this is what join points are about. The question is now, how do I refer to them from my aspect-oriented code? And that is where the so-called point cuts come into play. With a point cut, you you express your desire to place this callback for particular join points that you define with this point cut. So a point cut is in that sense one particular combination of situations related to join points that you want to place code in. So how can that be done? Well, usually you create these point cuts with this keyword point cut, give it a particular name with which you can refer to that particular combination of join points, and then define that with a combination of expressions. These are Boolean expressions. You can negate certain events. You can have disjunction or conjunctions of certain events. And what these events are is actual is defined in these primitives, which are designators of the particular join points. As a practical example, how can something like that look? There's the keyword point cut that introduces a new assembly of join points. We want to refer to this particular thing under the name of DFS, and this particular point cut consists of the join points from here or join points from here. So this is a disjunction. So this point cut triggers whenever either the DFS method in tree is executed or the DFS method in leaf is executed. So you see these green blocks from that side correspond to these so-called primitives, and in themselves they are point cut designators. And what you can use for those, we will see a little bit later on. What you keep in mind from this point cut thing is that you can combine different join points together to create exactly the situation in which you want to insert code in your system. So the way that you specify the code that you want to insert in your system is that you create a so-called advice and place that advice in an aspect block. So advices, as they are in essence just callback routines for certain situations, are much like methods themselves. They have some kind of header and then the actual code block which is meant to be executed for these join points. So this is how they are specified. So there is a particular header and the part where you specify the what should happen when the point cut is fulfilled. And for that you need to specify for once the actual point cut together with a definition of the timing when the callback should be actually called. So there's a notion of the callback being executed before a particular join point is then executed, or after a particular join point has terminated execution. And you can even outfit your after statement with intercepting the actual return value that might be produced by that particular join point that you wanted to precede here. So for that you have a returning or even a throwing clause. In our example, we start an aspect that we call doubler, and this thing defines an advice, this guy over here, that is meant to hook into a particular join point before it's actually executed, which is what is the point that we want to hook into? Well, that is whenever control reaches a call, method call, of the static signature, static type C of the receiver, name is foo, first parameter is of type int, and return type is also int. And in case this thing matches a particular runtime event, then the advice is executed, so this system out printing is executed then. Okay, so this is a very basic aspect that you can write. You might have wondered why there are actually brackets for these before and after, which I didn't explain before. This is because you can even refer to the actual runtime values that are there when that particular event might trigger or not. And you can actually access these runtime values by binding them to particular variable names that you then use for evaluating certain conditions, or even try to compute something useful with that. So that can be done with the primitive args and a particular argument list. So for our example of the doubler, we now add another designator called args that binds this name I to the parameter of type int, and you can use that with the declaration that you have put into this before clause over here. So with that you define the integer I that you bind to the first argument of the of this method call. With that you have introduced a variable that you can then use within the actual advice, and what we do here is we just, well, we take whatever value is prepared as the first parameter of the method call and modify it in the semantics that we indicated here in the aspect name, and what we do is we just double its value. So with that we can modify the runtime values that are present during the execution of the actual program. With this argless thing we can do even more advanced stuff. We can not only bind a value to a particular identifier, we can also filter for particular types. We can also use wildcards if we don't care for particular values, and even match several arguments not knowing which or how many of them are there in practice. Anyway, there's even another type of advice that is called around. So this is kind of a combination of the before and after thing, and this lets you in one code block perform computations that have a part that prefixes a particular event and succeed a particular event. And this sounds quite fine. However, the question is with a pointer designator like this, we will just get one particular block in order to provide all the code that is meant to be executed before and after. How can we then specify what happens before and what happens after? This is what we do via the proceed expression. That is the thing that we can use to dispatch to the actual to the actual event which we have surrounded with our user specified code. So this round was specified for a particular join point, and in order to actually reach the join point from within the callback specified for this advice, we can dispatch there while this proceed. In the example, we can see that here for the around, we again specify our variable in order to manipulate the parameter. What we do is with this advice we wrap around calls to at this point it's foo with object and int, and what we do is we first double the parameter, then perform the actual dispatching to the method that we have designated in our join point in our point cut, and take the result and then half it once again before we then return. So this is kind of a wrapper that first doubles it, then calls the method, then halves the result. Don't know how useful that actually is, but you might imagine that you can come up with something more meaningful for your particular problem. So, yeah, that is the around advice with the proceed thing. So, what are actual primitives that I can use in order to specify point cut designators? So far we have already seen a few in our examples that I thought to that were intuitive, but let's have a look at what's actually there. So there's the point cut designators that are related to method call. We have already talked about this the join points that are related to methods, and we have said that there's a difference between calling and executing, and this is, well, I try to graphically illustrate what this is all about. So there's once the point cut designator for method call. This will match this part of the control flow. So the one that is directly around the actual method call expression, and depending on whether it's after or around, it will match with point one. Then there is the execution, which will match with points 3 and 4, which are the starting points of a particular method, or the end point of a particular method, depending on whether it's before or after or around. And these two may seem equivalent whenever there's no dynamic dispatching involved. As soon as there is dynamic dispatching, those two don't necessarily behave the same way. So these two are not the same. Well, in some cases they are, but it is not necessarily like that. So you can also, of course, match calls to or executions to constructors, and thus you have a need of different ways of specifying this signature bit of the method call designators. So for regular methods, you specify that like this, whether carry a result type in the definition. For constructors, of course, there is no result type in that sense, other than the receiver type in that definition. So you leave that away and just by the way. I've talked about this difference in call execution for methods. How is this with respect to constructors? Are there cases where constructors or matching constructors with call and execution are actually different, or result in different goes in the direction of what that means, but it has certain consequences when it's not.
Yeah, but
it's
not
going to
be that.
So for the call of a constructor, I think this is pretty clear. That goes to everywhere where you find the expression and the actual name of the type and whatever parameter there is. Is there any other situation where a particular constructor might be? In these things already such an expression again. So in that sense, yes, but also the in that case also the call would. Find things like that is the execution of the constructor. So these are things which don't directly match the actual call expression somewhere. Maybe hearing the code, but it might be just kind of that you get you thinking. So, there's a larger example here. Okay, so the larger example here is definition of an actual class. Doesn't have much, there's just a string method that does three things, and the main method where we actually instantiate such a class and then perform some action on it. Okay, this is just consistent in printing out something related to the class. So, can bring an aspect into the game by defining the thing that, which is this call aspect. This is, has to do with the actual calls in the example above. And we define a point cut that we call call to string. And this is in the designator call to string. And we have the pointer execute to string, which has the designator execution of string in my class is a string. So what we also define is a particular advice, which is this guy over here, which is specified to trigger before the point cuts that we define later are reached, and the trigger before either call to string is reached or exec to string is reached. And in each of the cases, what we do is we will print out. So, where are, would you say are the points in the? Let's give them color. So this one is green. Which actual statement line will lead to this whole thing? Two, three, and four. Yes. It's still learning, so it's not. It's good. Way to go. So. This one for sure, I think, is one that we all agree on. The question is this one, is this in the bytecode? I'm not sure whether wrapping is also a thing for last cells, whether they work with a value or value. Do they do something like value off? C is five class. It's actually a question that whether it's four times or three times, and the answer is in that sense, well, it depends on what you, that's the indication process we were working on. So if you give them also the code thing to work with, then it might find another instance of this string thing and replace that with the actual hook, leading to a four times thing. If you restrict the class collection where to weave your code in to just the user code that you're writing, not the libraries, then it won't find the string that is internally called. So for our examples, what I did is I just gave it the my class thing. In case that you would have such a two-string visible in the code that you give the whole system, you would replace that. So in that sense, all it was depending on was what the mechanism that weaves the code in the actual target code, what it actually sees. So yeah, at some point this two-string happens. If it happens in bytecode and is visible to the weaver, then it will be woven in two. If that is not the case, then it happens like this, such that the call will just match to this one, while the execution will match every time that this thing is actually executed, which is, well, in there and in there, in that sense, twice. Thus, we have maybe this one to call, and these two guys emanating from the UI given. I would have to look up whether there's an actual, whether it really compiles into this convert. version, then it does that implicitly in the VM. I don't actually really know what to say at that point. So I can't really answer that thing right now. But anyway, you only show, for this example, I only show the iCloud part to the aspect system. So people only do that this thing. So I'm sure that part will only trigger the execution of the call. Still confused for a bit. Okay, good. So, next designators of interest are the ones related to field access. Remember, there are attributes, objects, classes, might be interested in hijacking every manipulation or readout of these things. For that, you can use these get or set primitives. And you need to qualify the actual field on which to hook into. And, well, that is with the usual syntax of the type of the field that you can actually batch with, the carrier in terms of the object type name, and the actual identifier that names this is this. You might wonder if you try to hook to the setting process of a particular attribute, how you could do something like that. And the answer is, well, in those cases you use the args primitive and can bind a particular name to the new value that is meant to be set to that particular thing, and for that you can do all kinds of mischief. So let's have a look at the guard setter, which is the example aspect here. So for this one, we can register an advice before something happens, and it binds a new value. And this new value is appropriately named because what we are binding to is the designator for setting field. What we do here is we register for whenever the field X of the type class is set to the value, and we bind to this new value with args class, and then we can register by the callback code, which in this case will just throw a runtime exception every time that we see the set. Based primitives that you can usually add to conditions on which you match your point cut. For example, you can add things like target or within code that lets you restrict the cases in which the callback code is actually triggered. So, for example, with this target type, you can restrict for the receiver to have an actual runtime type of whatever you give it, type or ID. Remember, this is an actual runtime type, so that's different from the, for example, method called static type that you provide the type signature. And there's the within clause, where you can restrict matching of the join points to join points that are occurring within the body of a particular class that you give it with a type pattern. Or you can restrict join points to the ones that occur during the execution of a particular method by the within code. you see that in action in the little bit more liberal primitives, control flow and if. So there's the primitive control flow, or C flow for short, that will restrict matching of particular join point to well, depending on what point type you give a parameter to this primitive, every element that matches with that particular point cut matches only whenever the join point is occurring after the beginning of the particular other join point. And this is particularly interesting for method calls. So if you say that you want to match C flow of the method call F, for example, then you restrict triggering the advice only to trigger for any join point that happens in, well, wherever the control flow goes after the method call has started and before the method call has ended. So this is a way of, for example, keeping any more complex join points from triggering before you have reached an actual interesting point in your program. You might want to use that, for example, when you want to restrict things like error logging to a certain collection of methods that are all started from within a particular constructor or method. So this restricts the execution of advices to the point between to any control flow point between the start and the end point of a particular other point cut. So this is the control flow thing. The other one that is quite unspecified in that sense is this one over here, which gives you the chance to provide any dynamic property that you would like in this Boolean expression, and this is then evaluated at every possible join point that is passed in the program, and whenever this is passed, the expression is evaluated, and if it matches, then the advice is triggered. So with that, you can have arbitrary conditions on wherever to trigger. You of course need some kind of particular naming scheme to actually address anything of interest that is available at that particular join point. So in our case, you see this is this join point keyword, and with that you can obtain other useful properties. So in our example here, we have again the it's called guarded sector. I'm not so sure whether ignore the name of the aspect for now. So we register an advice to trigger before a particular condition happens, and our condition here is this one that arbitrary that matches arbitrary join points. So we execute will be executed for every join point and checks whether the kind of the join point equals, well, particular constant. This is a constant that is defined in the join points constant and can be used for comparing whatever this join point is, for example. So this is a very, very specific specialized property already, and it makes use of whatever the SPECJ environment gives us to work with. But with that you can manually express the same thing as this call thing would have done, with maybe one crucial difference. This dynamic property is a thing that is usually not touched by the optimizer of such an aspect of a system. So this is a thing that will be evaluated all the time, no matter what actually really is there, and there's no attempt to optimize to not evaluate that in case that we match, for example, a getter or a setter. So this will be evaluated every time that anything of interest is found. In order for that whole thing to not trigger on the advice itself, because the advice itself also has a method call in there, what you usually do for these kinds of things is that you restrict the possible join points that might trigger that thing, or the evaluation of that thing, otherwise you might end up with a lot of recursion in there. And for our purposes, we do that with the within clause that will tell the system to only evaluate the dynamic property whenever anything of my class is available. So that is the more liberal things in that sense. So the question is now, in such a system, of course I can happily develop my core functionality and then add aspects as I need them, depending on whatever I want to realize with in my system. And I maybe at some point end up with lots of advices that at some point compete about actual access to certain join points that are triggering events. And you might wonder whether it's somehow possible to give well, precedence to one or the other. For example, in cases where you have this around thing that might prevent the after from ever triggering, because you might not even use the proceed at some point. So it's actually crucial to be able to somehow define the relation between these things, and you can do that with so-called precedence declarations, and these are possible with just these precedence statements over here, and in that sense you would give the advice from aspect A precedence over the advice from aspect B. Then there's some kind of natural precedence in case that one aspect is defined within another aspect. So there's a kind of sub-aspect, not within, but refining another aspect. So the most specialized one is the one that gets precedence in terms of executing its advice. And in every other case, you don't have an actual well-defined precedence on that, and any execution would actually be possible, and even an inconsistent one. So if you have aspects that compete on particular join points, then and you are actually doing crucial things that keep other advices from working properly, then this is for you. Yeah. What is the other one? If you don't. Oh yeah. Well, this is of course also a problem if you have advices within the same aspect. So there's need to clarify if two advices within the same aspect match for the same join points, which of them has precedence. But for that, you can use the sequence in which they appear within the aspect, and that gives you the precedence rules for that. So much for the specification of the thing, of the aspect-oriented systems. Is there a question on that still? Then there's the matter of implementation of such a system. So there's several design choices that you can do for implementing aspect-oriented systems, and particularly the process of integrating the aspects in the target code is called aspect weaving. And for the way that you perform aspect weaving, there are several approaches that you can So there's one that is the so-called pre-processing idea, which would mean that you would have sources of the target system available. In these situations, you can run the aspect weaver as a preprocessor on your Java source code, and the aspect weaver would add functionality that is new to the class bodies and or rewrite the places that need further changing, like access a field or something like that. You need to actually modify the method bodies where this actually happens. And the processed or rewritten sources are then piped into the actual compiler, and the compiler itself doesn't even realize that this aspect of the code and produces certain output. So that is one way of doing that. The next one is during compilation. So this would mean not to use the standard Java C compiler, but have a modified version of that, which is aware of the aspect that you defined, and while processing the original sources, incorporates the changes needed for supporting the aspects. This would, of course, mean that while the target language is actually evolving and produces more modern language features, you would have to carry your implementation with the target compiler and go the same steps as the main compiler. This is kind of a lot of work. Next idea is the post-compile processor. That is what I've called it with the preprocessor approach in mind, but you could also call it bytecode rewriting or something like that. So what you do in these things would be you take the results of the plain original target language's compiler and modify the outcome of that such that the aspect semantics are hooked into the foremost working system. That means, of course, that you need to be able to somehow support all the semantics that you've defined before, like this being able to interject whatever a thing is called, whenever a thing is executed, whenever a field is set, whenever a field is get, and so on, is gotten, and so on. Somehow need to find reliable places in the target code to actually hook your code into. And turns out that, of course, this thing, or this that particular approach was already planned with a certain idea of implementation in mind, that the semantics that you can express in the aspect language are designed in a way such that you can actually find anchor points in the bytecode such that you can place the code in there. So it's already designed with the implementation of such a post-compile processor or bytecode rewriting tool in mind. Another idea would be going for a weaving process that would just work as a custom virtual machine, in the sense that it would take the plain bytecode from your plain old Java compiler, and then the interpretation hooked into the flow of the program at the same point that you specified the aspect and then switch over to the aspect code. Possible, but has similar problems as the compilation process. You have to go along with development in the virtual machine, and that's the virtual machine, and work. So far, this post-compile processor has proved to be the most viable solution to go. So there has been, I think, in the beginnings, there has been a few years when there was an implementation with an actual preprocessor around, but as far as I remember or know, the post-compile processor solution is the one that is actually favored at the moment. So take it with a grain of salt. That's what I am aware of, and busy mind with a lot of different languages. There might be progress. Of course, there's also you can also think of combinations of the methods from above, but in reality, it's usually this post-compile process. So, how does such a solution look like in practical examples? So, that is now the example where you have a target language example, where there's just a constant expression where you access the value with a setter, and you can define, of course, an aspect with an advice, especially for that situation. So there's setting of const value attribute, and you might be interested in hooking the control flow before this join point is actually reached and execute this particular thing. And that could be realized. How? Well, the thing is that something like the setting of a field is very unique procedure in the virtual machine. This is realized by just one particular instruction, namely this put field thing. And, well, in JVM you always have the string pool, that's why this hash 54 is there, and you see the translation over here. This is just a string pool coding for const val of type integer. So, by just scanning the decompiled, or well, from bytecode to JVM code, decompiled target code, we can already locate every statement where a particular field is actually executed. So it's in that sense easy to then realize registering before it actually happens. So that's done over here. These two things which have been inserted before the targeted instruction is executed, and this just consists of this scope static, which gives a reference to the actual aspect on which you then call the before my aspect, and well, whatever the aspect viewer has given as the name to that, which is actually then in the end dispatched to the advice from over here, and then call the that is how, in a simple case, the weaving can be done. Of course, this can be arbitrarily complicated. For example, if you add other conditions, like this target, and if you do so, oh well, of course, what this says that we have an actual call to signature. So what we need to do here is we need to find patterns of code that relate to calling certain methods, and we can actually do so. There is just one instruction in the Java Virtual Machine that deals with the method to look up whether it's a static method or a dynamic method by just checking the definition of that thing. So you can check whether it's invoked static or invoked virtual, and then you can have a look at the parameter, which is decoded into an actual method signature, like this one, which tells us that this method is all this method call is all about object to string, and it returns a Java language string. So with that, we can just do once again a search on the decompiled bytecode, and then find that thing and register another advice before that, so we insert before. But this time, well, we need to do a little bit more. Particularly, we need to evaluate whether the target is actually an expression thing at runtime. So this is a thing that's now not so simple anymore, because that is a runtime property and cannot really be read from the signature of the call, because this is just the static signature of the whole thing. So there's object there, not the actual expo thing. So the way that this is solved is done, well, if it's only available through runtime, we need to runtime check in there, and that's what's done here. So this is this loads the receiver of the whole thing, and does an instance of test with string pool number one, which is just a picture. And if the whole thing is equal, then I don't exactly remember the semantics. If it then falls through, and if else, then it jumps over there, something like that. I don't actually remember. But it falls based on the actual type of the receiver thing, and if it decides that the receiver is actually an expert, then it dispatches to the advice once again with this invoke static and invoke virtual, and then falls through to the actual execution of the method call, or, well, jumps over the execution of the advice. So with everything like this target expression, you will see that you add a few runtime checks to every instance of invoke virtual on this static signature. So that is what you have to be aware of whenever you use such a thing as this target. So it doesn't stop there. There's even more complexity involved when you have this combination of around and exceed. Remember, there's a way of specifying that you want to wrap certain code around the execution of a certain join point, and you completely dispatch to the join point with mentioning this proceed keyword, as in the example that we have had earlier with this with matching a particular call and doubling and modifying the result once again. So we proceed with the double parameter and return half of the result. So in order to realize something like this, you might have to react to situations like this one over here, where you then create a relevant class and then call foo thing. And how would you realize something like that? Well, you would of course do something like that in the JVM part, but because this is quite hard to read, not even with a few years of reading JVM code, this is fun. So I decided to compile or decompile that sort of back into ordinary Java-like code. But you must be aware that these pinky things here are originally just JVM code that I retranslated for your own convenience. So what happens in that situation is that you will get your advice implemented in some carrier method, like this foo around body one advice thing, which performs the relevant transformation of these things, and internally then calls this method, which is just essentially this thing over here. So you could also maybe deal with that in here. So there's no, I didn't really see any advantage in having this full run body zero thing, but I don't know, maybe I'm just too stupid to see that. So what it does is it replaces the code that has been there before with a call to the actual advice, and within the advice then this proceed thing is directly translated into another method call, which contains the original original join point pattern. This didn't seem so difficult, but you must keep in mind that within the specification of the advice, you have the full expressive power of something like Java, and that enables you of doing arbitrary stuff in there. And usually, what you can do in there is some store outside of the space for computer that will also be longer. This is particularly nasty since you can, for example, also leak the reference to the call that you were wrapping, which is around advice, and thus have to somehow enable the possibility to call this this thing outside of its original calling context. So this means, of course, that you also need to take care that the original parameters that have been there while the call has originally been set up are still available to be used as parameters. So what would be an example where this is actually really tricky to realize? That is the one you see over here. So there's C with a full implementation, and the main method calls it, and our aspect doubler could, for example, do some crazy stuff like the one you see over here, where you define a closure in which you actually use the proceed thing there. And that is the way that reference to the method can be delayed and later on executed whenever the future from over here is in the end executed. So this means, of course, that the original parameter I has to survive and be accessible until the actual evaluation of this method call is there. So in order to do something like that, you see that there's not more concepts here. So the decompilation of the whole thing meant that you see that there's a closure like you have in functional languages created, which carries all the necessary values of the parameters on which the method is later on then called, and is conserved in this parent object, which is used to build up the closure, which is used in order to in the end perform at some point exclude the whole thing. And yeah, you see that it can become quite complicated. I don't want you to go too deep into that right now, because that's really messy and ugly in there. But you just need to be aware of the fact that with this, well, with advices being basically full-blown Java code, you can create messy situations like these, where you can leak certain references and objects in places where they haven't in the original program, and that leads to some preparations to do so. So that is done in AspectJSON 2 with this shadow class. Few notes maybe, because beforehand I've talked about the dynamic properties and the way to make it from the non-dynamic properties. There's ideas of optimizing how Aspect J does its work, in the sense that so far we have accepted the fact that for checking whether an advice is at a particular point to be triggered or not by evaluating the conditions of your point cut designators. This might be quite costly if you have to do that for all the possible events out there. So there's ways of optimizing that in the sense that you would, for example, implement something like shadow stack, where you only modify the properties collected so far that are might be of interest for triggering your particular advice. Keep them on the stack and only modify the stack whenever there's an actual event happening that modifies anything that has something to do with your particular interests, and so that the actual checking of your whether your point cut is now triggering can be reduced to checking every time that that this shadow stack is actually modified, and can also be condensed on just the properties that are kept in this particular stack. So this would be one way of optimizing for that. But there's still room for optimization out there, and there's this has been at least ongoing work for the the last 10 years. I don't know how active the whole scene is right now. I think they have been revived a little bit by the introduction of Java annotations, and there's ways of defining aspect-oriented additions to your program with these Java 5 annotations now, but I would have to recheck that. So, all in all, what is some of the implementation for the before and after advice? This is for even the around advice. There's different complexity in realizing these things. This can range from just inline code at appropriate code patterns to several methods and closures whenever join points are usually identified with well-known patterns in that sense that can then be attributed with wrappers to the actual advices. Yeah, and there's dynamic dispatch, which means that there could be some cost added to the actual runtime whenever you have to check for certain things, like whether there's you find yourself targeting one particular runtime class or anything. This adds actual extensive code to your to potential targets. And for flow-sensitive point cuts, you might have a very costly naive implementation, which can be optimized, but still carries a little bit of cost with it, no matter what. So, all in all, for aspect orientation, you've seen new ideas for untangling of concerns and adding extensions to already existing frameworks afterwards, and well, overall you can program in a way where you add another layer of abstraction to your system, which might be quite nice. However, what you buy yourself into is a little bit of runtime overhead when doing the actual, well, as a result of the weaving of certain dynamic properties. The control flow might look a little bit intransparent, particularly if you are moving on the regular old plain Java code side and don't have any tool support in order to actually notify you of any aspects defined somewhere else. So, yeah, debugging and IDE support is crucial for that kind of development. And once again, oh yeah, probably this carries over to the version that I have online, I don't know. Probably the online version will have more than just a plain black page on there, so maybe check there for references. Yeah, so that's all from my side for today. Next time we'll have a look into the next further step of metaprogramming, so next time it's real metaprogramming. Thank you very much and have a nice week.